MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Brent. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
Likewise, mate. I've got a couple of listener questions, so let's start with those. How about we go first for Morris? Morris says, Brent, can you ask Dr. Ross if aspirin intake is necessary when one is on a regular intake of Bergamet Advance? He said, I have had a heart bypass in 2017 and I'm doing well.
Oh, no, absolutely he needs aspirin. Bergamet doesn't really have a profound effect on blood thinning. It's good for other metabolic things, and I always have to say I do have an association with a company. I do research for them. But Bergamet is good for you for other reasons, but he should have aspirin if you've had coronary artery bypass grafting. Aspirin shouldn't be used as a prevention just because people think it will keep them healthier. But if you've had a bypass, a stent or a heart attack, aspirin or an aspirin equivalent, there's another drug called clopidogrel, which is relatively similar, something should be there as a blood thinner.
Okay, Joanne says, I've seen vitamin D in a spray. How does that compare to taking a tablet?
Oh, exactly the same. You're still getting a dose of vitamin D. In fact, we get our good dose of vitamin D absorbed by the skin, so you can certainly absorb it sublingually. So the dose, and the dose is typically the same. And what I say to all people, I all think we need 2,000 units daily of vitamin D. So one spray is typically 1,000 international units. And the only thing is, let me say, there are sprays that combine vitamin D with vitamin K2. And the problem is typically those sprays don't have enough vitamin K2. So the dose of vitamin K2 I suggest people take every day is 180 micrograms, whereas the sprays only tend to have 45 micrograms. But sprays, whether you swallow it or whether you get it on a spray, you'll get the same dose typically.
What's the benefit of the vitamin K2, Ross?
Okay, vitamin K2 takes the calcium out of your arteries, so makes your arteries more flexible and puts it back in your bones. So you get two bangs for your buck with vitamin K2. So I have all of my cardiac patients on vitamin K2, anyone who has osteoporosis, I put them on vitamin K2, so it's a good general all-purpose supplement that has significant benefits as you get older.
Andrew sent me an article yesterday or the day before about blood pressure, and the article came from, I think, the Harvard Medical School or something like that, and it said that the next time you have your blood pressure checked, don't be surprised if your doctor checks it in each arm. And they say there could be a significant difference in the pressure recorded in the right and the left arms. Tell us more about this, Ross. Do you agree? Do you disagree? What's your thoughts?
No, I totally agree. And as we get older, there is the potential for us to get blockages in the blood vessels that come off the heart. So you have the subclavian arteries that go to one the right subclavian to the right side, left subclavian to the other side. And then what happens, you can get blockages in those arteries, which then diminishes the blood pressure on one side, where you might have normal or high blood pressure on the other side. So if there's a difference between about 15 millimetres, you can have up to about 15 millimetres as a normal variation just because of the bending in the different arteries. But if it's higher than 15 millimetres, in fact, it's the one on with the lower blood pressure that would indicate the side where there's a blockage. And it's typical in people who have severe atherosclerosis or blockages in their other arteries elsewhere.
Okay, you say a difference of 10 to 15. Let's use a normal blood pressure reading. For example, 120 over 80. If your left arm shows you 120 over 80 and your right arm shows you 135 over 80, is that the 15 we're talking about, or is it in is it in the 80 top that we're talking about?
No, it's the top reading we're talking about, exactly what you've said. So 120 as opposed to 135, that's when you'd start to show some concerns. But let's face it, most people don't have their blood pressure checked in both arms. I tend to get that done in my patients if they also have known vascular disease elsewhere. But if a healthy 40-year-old comes in, I won't check the blood pressure in both arms.
What does it mean if you are a healthy person? And I mean, you know, I suppose we've got a mean average audience of probably above 60. What if you're above 60, over the age of 60, and your blood pressure is continually under 120 over 80? I'm not talking a low blood pressure, but I'm talking maybe a reading of 110 over 68.
that means you're incredibly healthy, and I'd congratulate you typically, unless you're getting symptoms. So people, say, walking around in a fog and they feel dizzy all the time and their blood pressure's 100 on 60, there may be some pathology going on that needs to be investigated. But typically, our blood pressure should be below 120 over 80, but they're typically not because we live in this society. We're exposed to far too much salt, stress, alcohol. People have pot bellies. They don't do exercise. All of these things contribute to the blood pressure going higher.
Okay, let's talk about sleep. Recent research on sleep reveals unexpected connections between the brain and the gut. Sleep is just, I mean, sleep is so important, isn't it? And good quality sleep is so important. And we keep hearing more news and different stories coming at us, telling us how important good quality sleep is to our overall well-being.
Well, there's no doubt that 7 to 8 hours of good quality sleep per night is as good for your body as not smoking, just as one example. But there's also a strong link between people who sleep less than 6 hours per night or more than 9 hours per night and all sorts of diseases, cardiovascular disease, obesity, diabetes, many common cancers as well, dementia. So there's so many links to poor sleep and disease. But also, Brent, you and I have spoken for a number of years on the link between the gut and almost about every other organ system in the body. So there's the gut-brain axis, which is sort of what we're talking about now. There's the gut-heart axis, the gut-immune system axis. Just to give you one example, 90% of the serotonin, which is our mood chemical, is made in the gut. Now, this particular study that's come out has looked at a gene that's in the gut and in the brain. The gene, the name doesn't matter, but it's CCHA1. And if you delete that in fruit flies, they have incredible wakefulness. But it's only if you delete it in their gut. So that's the weird thing. If you delete it in the brain, it doesn't do anything to their sleep. But if you fiddle around with it in the gut, it does. So what they're suggesting is that there could be a leak to a defective gut microbiome, which is then affecting all these, the gene expression in the gut and how you sleep. So it's getting more and more complex. But it just shows, it's so interesting how we're not just our brain or our liver or our heart. We're the whole body connected together. And we're 40 trillion human cells and 40 trillion bacterial cells. So the gut microbiome has to be pretty damn important.
For people that are finding it difficult to get good quality sleep, there are lots of different things you can take. You go into your local chemist and you'll probably find that most of these tablets have got valerian yep. in them. Can you take, yep. I mean, is that the sort of thing that you need to take to give you better sleep?
Oh, yeah, there's a whole lot of natural things on the market. Valerian's one of them that can give you slightly better sleep. I mean, we always talk about sleep hygiene, which is going to bed at the same time approximately, waking up at the same time in the morning, sleeping in a cool, dark room, getting all electronics out of your bedroom. Don't ever see alcohol as a sedative. Many people say, oh, I'll have a few drinks because it helps me get off to sleep. But what it also does is completely disrupt your sleeping patterns. And so you get incredible sleep disruption if you drink. And also things like caffeine. I mean, for example, I'm an under-metabolizer of caffeine or a slow metabolizer of caffeine. So if I have coffee beyond about 4 o'clock, I just don't sleep at night. I just don't metabolize it. Whereas I know people who can have a double shot latte before they go to bed. It doesn't affect their sleeping at all. So there's all of those things as well. But there are a number of different natural products in the market that may promote sleep. And I'll have some exciting news for you next week. I'm not going to talk about it today. But next Tuesday, I'll talk about the link between a newly prescribed sleeping pill and potentially less dementia.
If you're taking these sleep complexes, can you take them on a regular basis for an ongoing period of time, or should you do that?
No, I don't think there's any problem with doing that. There's no known toxicity from these things, but I make the point all the time that almost all things you use have about a 10% side effect rate. And obviously, the more synthetic it is, so with pharmaceutical drugs, the side effects are higher. And there's been all this hoo-ha about vaccines, and we still get the filthy letters from the anti-vaxxers. But the point is that no vaccine is safe either, but you've got to look at the safety of the condition versus the safety of the treatment, or the risk of the condition versus the safety of the treatment. And so I make the example with vaccines. If you put measles through a community of children, one in 1,000 get a thing called subacute sclerosing panencephalitis, which is as bad as it sounds. But then if you vaccinate a bunch of children, one in 10,000 will get the same condition, which may leave them intellectually disabled for the rest of their days. And so what the message there is, the same message with the COVID vaccines, the disease is 10 times worse than the actual vaccine, but the vaccine still has a potential risk in some predisposed people.
Okay, vitamin D, we've talked about this afternoon. Let's talk about it again. Combine vitamin D, omega-3 fatty acids, and a simple home exercise program may actually reduce cancer, the risk of cancer, among active adults aged 70 and older.
Yeah, this was a study of 2,157 people. It was a three-year study, average age about 75. And you see, this is a point that people need to realize about cancer. It takes one cancer cell 9 years to become a 2-centimeter tumor, and then because of tumor doubling time, within 6 months, it then becomes 2 kilos worth of tumor if it's not treated. So these cancers were already existing in people, but it found that the people who took 2,000 international units of vitamin D a day, which is what I said before, a gram a day of omega-3. Now, that's not 1,000 milligrams of fish oil, because fish oil has typically about 180 to at sometimes 300 milligrams of omega-3 in one fish oil capsule. So therefore, you've got to take at least 3 to 4 fish oil capsules a day, and just a simple home exercise program, which just means doing regular exercise. Over a three-year period, wait for this, reduced invasive cancer by 61%. So the people who developed the cancers already had existing cancers for the reasons I said. But the actual simple things that we've mentioned, the three things, vitamin D, omega-3, and exercise, reduced the risk of the cancer that was already existing spreading by 61%, which is pretty powerful for something as harmless as the three things we just said there.
Is krill oil the same as omega-3 fish oil?
Oh, yeah. Krill has omega-3, but it also has other stuff in it. There's a thing called astaxanthin, which is a pretty strong antioxidant, and that enhances the benefits of the krill. So krill's a really good omega-3, good anti-inflammatory, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay. There is a new potential, a cancer treatment. This is for DIPG, which is diffuse intrinsic, pontine glioma?
Absolutely, that's what it is. And let me tell you what it is, but I'm sure most of the audience haven't heard of this before, but this is a horrible, horrible cancer that affects little children. And it gets into the brain stem of their brain. They can't have an operation because it's too close to what we call tiger country in medicine. If you went in there and tried to cut it out, the children are left absolutely disabled. So there's really no treatment for it. They get very sick with chemotherapy, and it might give them a few extra months, but it's just a horrible, horrible condition. So there's a fellow in the US called Professor Adrian Craner, who's been using these treatments. We call them antisense oligonucleotides, which are used not just for this particular condition, but for a whole lot of other things. So there's a dreadful condition called spinal muscular atrophy that affects children as well. And he developed this antisense oligonucleotide, which really helps these kids with spinal muscular atrophy. But he tweaked the molecule a bit to affect a particular protein that leads to this DIPG, and found that in mice, he cured the mice of the condition. So we're talking about a potential treatment for something that up to now would universally kill little kids who got it. So it's quite exciting news.
Ross, colder temperatures may help clear... Well, tell us about colder temperatures and Alzheimer's.
Yeah, this is interesting. There's a fellow called Professor David Sinclair, who's the world anti-aging guru. He's an Australian who's now Professor of Anti-Aging Medicine at Harvard University. And he speaks in his wonderful book, Lifespan, about the potential for treating all manner of diseases, including aging, by just getting a bit of cold, getting out in the cold. And we've spoken about the benefits, say, for example, of cold water swimming. Well, this was a study that was done in animals where they looked at the effects of exposing them to cold and these things called amyloid proteins in the brain. And they found that by exposing them to colder temperatures, they fixed up all the amyloid proteins in the brain and reduced this. So it was quite exciting to think that potentially something simple as being exposed to colder weather may actually reduce your risk for progressing to Alzheimer's disease. So what Dave Sinclair does, he walks around the streets of Harvard University in Boston in winter with just a T-shirt on to get himself cold, which I think is a bit extreme, but he says there's good evidence for it.
What about, there seems to be this new trend, mate, that take an ice bath. Ice baths are really good for you. I mean, we've heard about, you know, sporting people getting into an ice bath after they come off the football field and it helps their muscles, for example. But these days, you see, particularly on social media, all sorts of people getting into an ice bath. What are the benefits of that?
Well, I think it's the same thing. The cold water just has an effect on the immune system, effect on repairing damaged proteins. Because as we all get older, every time you have a thought, a motion, you use your muscles or whatever, you create a waste product that then can eventually become these junk proteins. And these junk proteins then affect normal metabolism. So it appears that all forms of cold tend to improve these junk proteins. So this is just one of these mechanisms. It's really quite exciting.
So it's not just an old wives' tale that what you should do after you've had a shower of a morning, if you're having a hot shower, what you should do before you get out of that shower is turn the hot water off and just have a cold shower very quickly.
Yep. Yeah, I think it's probably a good thing to do.
Oh, dear. Okay, hearing aids may protect against a higher risk of dementia associated with hearing loss. Obviously, I'm reading about this at the moment.
Yes, I just thought this was also important when we're talking about cold temperatures to look at some other things that may help Alzheimer's disease. There's a thing from the UK Biobank, which has been a study that's been going for a long time of about 500,000 people, and it found that of the 500,000 people, around 100,000 had some degree of hearing loss, but only 12% of those people used some form of hearing aid. And they found that the people who didn't use the hearing aid versus those who did use the hearing aid with hearing loss had a 40% increase in dementia by not using the hearing aids. So it seems like if you have any sort of issues with your hearing, it's important to get onto the hearing aid or think about a cochlear implant.
You took the words right out of my mouth. One of the things that we talked about the other day to the doctor that I'm seeing, and that is people will go and they'll have, and I've got to be quick because we've got to go, but people will go and have their eyes checked, people will go and have their teeth checked, but people just don't think about their hearing, so they don't go and have a regular hearing test as we get older, and you should do that.
Oh, absolutely. It's a vital, it's just like having your sight checked. You should have your hearing checked as well.
All right, Ross, I've got to love you and leave you. Thanks, mate, for fitting in with us on a Friday. We're back to a Tuesday next week.
Yeah, talk to you next Tuesday, mate. Have a good weekend.
You too, mate. Okay, bye-bye.